Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will, how are you?
I'm good. Hi, Carlton.
Hello. And this week we've got with us special guest Erin Mullaney, who's going to come on. We're going to talk about freelancing and things like that. Hi, Erin, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing really well. How are you?
Marvelous, marvelous. A bit tired of being locked in the house, but other than that, we're good.
Sure. I think we all are getting a little tired of that, although I've been a remote worker for, I think, 3 years now. So I feel very well prepared for this moment in time.
Yeah.
Well, and Carlton, you're literally locked in the house in Spain, right?
No, there's a lockdown in Spain.
It's quite serious. I mean, I was just outside with my kids. Can you go outside in your yard?
No.
Or do you have a yard?
No, we can go in our back garden, but we're not allowed out in the street. And that's been the same for 6 weeks.
Yeah, with four kids, everyone.
Yeah. So,
you can't go for walks?
No, we can go to the shop or the pharmacy, and you can go as a single adult. And the police are quite strict about it. And, you know, I mean, Spain's been very heavily hit, so it's understandable.
Absolutely.
Everyone's starting to look if there can be some easing, because the kids need to get out and run a bit. But I think it's going to be a few more weeks yet. So anyway, but...
Well, they have mandatory face masks where I'm from in Brookline, Mass, with $50 fines. So that's about as strict as America gets with it. Anywho.
So working from home, I mean, working remotely, so I've been doing that a long time as well. So for me, the change wasn't too bad, apart from the fact that I've got children at home the whole time, which obviously...
You're not baking sourdough bread all the time and catching up on Netflix, Carlton?
No.
I think if I wasn't able to go for walks, I think my code would really suffer personally. So I would really miss that. I hope you get back to that soon, Carlton.
Yeah, no, I miss that. I do get to do a bit of Tai Chi outside, but I just want to go for a walk, please. Anyway, we should talk about freelancing and...
Yeah, well, you gave a fantastic DjangoCon talk, which we'll link to in the notes, and I want to talk to you about. But first... How does one come into the Django world? What was your origin story?
So my origin story for coding kind of begins when I was working part-time while I was in college. So I went to college for computer science, actually, luckily, although...
You're the only one here who can say that on this podcast.
Yeah. I think that people feel funny about not having gone to school for computer science, and I just want to tell them that it really doesn't matter. I mean, I'm glad I went to school for computer science. It's kind of a cool thing to put on my resume, but where I learned to code was at multiple jobs. So while I was...
All my closest Django friends didn't study it at all.
Yeah. And I was talking to a friend recently about it, and she was like, well, of course you went to school for computer science, so I feel like I have to catch up every night and learn these things. And I was like, no, please shut your computer off at 10 p.m. at least and get a good night of sleep. That's way more important. But I digress.
I think that attitude, it's important to note that, I mean, you know, the imposter syndrome and everything. I don't know, Carlton, I'm curious what you would say. I would say that I certainly... The feeling doesn't go away. I just put it in context where I know that nobody knows everything and I don't go around apologizing for it. I don't know. So it's, you know, I don't know. I don't feel the need to apologize because no one can just whip off whiteboard algorithms. And I've had to do that before. And
so I didn't do computer science at university. I've spent 20 years reading all the right books and doing all things, not college constantly, but on the back burner. And so I kind of feel like I know that stuff well enough, but how often does it come in handy? I don't never have to implement an algorithm. The library always
a compiler. Yeah. When's the last time you did a compiler from scratch?
You know, I might write a parser from time to time. That stuff's handy, you know, but I don't know. No, it's totally not the most relevant thing in the world, but
I think part of it too, is you get to know the people who are experts and you realize where they're at. And then you go, there is no white unicorn person that we think is out there who, you know, knows everything off the top of their head. Everyone has pretty major gaps. It's just you don't need to tell everyone about them all the time.
Yeah.
Especially if you're applying for a job.
Right. And nobody expects you to know everything in their heart. They don't expect you to just like have this like amazing amount of experience to just know everything without looking it up. I mean, I look everything up every day. Yeah, that's I think that's like the key to being a good programmer, is to know how to look things up and know who to ask questions to, like you were talking about with experts. But anyway, I was so I was in college, and I was working 20 hours a week at this office as an admin person. They found out I was going to school for computer science. They liked me. They saw that I was a hard worker, and they said, "Do you want to transfer sort of into a more coding role?" So this is around the year like 2000. So there was a lot of needs, like the Y2K stuff. There was a lot of needs around coding, and this was a mutual fund company, so they had a lot of needs, and they actually had a lot of I think they were either Fortran or COBOL programmers.
Yeah, I was gonna
there.
Say that sounds like textbook COBOL Fortran kind of.
Yeah. But they also had a department that was doing Visual Basic and Microsoft SQL, and then getting into .NET. So they said, "Do you want to like kind of translate into that department, and we'll hook you up with a coding mentor who can help you?" And so I, at this job, I learned about source control. Do you all remember? I'm going to age myself. Visual Source Safe. I mean, I learned how to use that. I learned Microsoft SQL, and I learned ASP at that time, a little bit of that, and a lot of Visual Basic. So this is going back to like 20 years ago. So that was my first programming job, and I was doing that 20 hours a week and then doing that full time in the summertime. And then when I graduated college, I continued there full time for a year, and then transferred, took a different job at the University of Pennsylvania, where I did Cold Fusion for many years and Microsoft SQL, a lot of SQL, a lot of Cold Fusion. So that's really where I think like we're always constantly learning in this industry. So I like to say that's where I was like really thrown into the fire, because there they were, the department I was working for was supporting so many different applications. So I would switch from working on a Flash application one day to working on a Cold Fusion the next, and just sort of fixing bugs on all these different platforms. So I really felt in a good way thrown into this environment where I had to learn quickly. And I was hooked up with some good mentors there too. So how I got to Django eventually down the line was they eventually decided to no longer support Cold Fusion because Cold Fusion was not going to be supported anymore. I don't know if either of you have heard of Cold Fusion, maybe?
Yeah.
So we were like a fully Adobe shop. We were doing Cold Fusion and Flash, and if you've heard of Flex, we were doing that. So I'm going to Adobe Max every year, which was super fun. So they, as a department at the University of Pennsylvania, I was specifically working at the Wharton School, and they decided Wharton-wide, we are no longer going to support Cold Fusion apps. We're going to sunset it. We have to pick a different language framework. So they had a task force for it, and this was Wharton-wide. So this is like all sorts of like smaller departments had to like be on board for this. So it took some time for them to choose a framework. In the end, it was between Django and a Java framework that I don't remember, and Django won. And I took that as, okay, Django's the thing I need to get into now. So while we were starting to translate apps from Cold Fusion to Django there, I was looking for my next job because I was ready to move to a new state. So I was moving from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania to North Carolina. And that is how I ended up doing Django, because Wharton kind of chose it, and then I used it as part of my looking for a new job. I really liked working at Wharton, but I wanted to move and I wanted to change things up. So I took a job. So I started applying to jobs in North Carolina, and a friend of mine sent me a listing in Durham, North Carolina, at this place called Cactus Group. And it just, all the stars aligned. They had an opening. I came down and interviewed there, and it kind of happened a little bit more quickly than I was ready for. We weren't quite ready to move to North Carolina, but the job was right. So I took the job at that Django firm and started really really learning Django very, very quickly. And that was 5 years ago in early 2015.
Right, because like perhaps listeners don't know, but Cactus is one of the sort of older, more established Django agencies. You know, they've been around forever and part of the community and, you know, still are. And
I think 12 years or something like that. Yeah. They had their 10-year anniversary recently. I'm trying to remember if it was 1 year or 2 years ago. But yeah, they're fairly established in the Django world. But I didn't know that at the time. I was just interviewing at a place that did Django.
And well, yeah, it's a good choice. I mean, I try really hard not to pick favorites, but I would say they're definitely in a small number of elite Django consulting firms I recommend to people when they ask.
Yeah, and at the time and still currently, a lot of the people there were really amazing mentors for me. And it was a great time to join there. I don't know if you remember Mark Lavin. He was there at the time. Karen Tracy is still there. Right. And a number of other people who were able to work with me in this position where I was a longtime coder, but not long time with Django. So yeah.
What makes a good mentor for you? Because we, you know, it's one of the difficult ones. People always ask for mentoring, and you always, as a, you know, a senior or established or long time hand, you think, oh, I'd like to mentor. But then what is it that makes a good mentor?
I think I'd rather answer the question of what makes a good mentee.
Okay.
And put yourself into the mentee's shoes, because I think of myself as both a mentor and a mentee in different relationships with different people. And so when I was coming, I'll talk about when I was coming to Cactus, because I've been mentored throughout my whole career. But really, when I came to Cactus, here I am, this longtime developer. I know the ropes pretty well, but as far as Django goes, I'm getting my feet wet and proving myself. So the best way that I could be a good mentee was to really not push it too hard. So I would schedule time with people and say, can you pair program with me for the next 45 minutes on this problem? And we would set a time together, and one of us would be the driver. And that's how I learned about breakpoints, because breakpoints was not a thing in Cold Fusion. Cold Fusion, it was just totally, it was a different idea. So I learned about breakpoints by sitting down with a developer, probably Vinod at Cactus Group. And he was using IPDB, and I learned about them from him. And, you know, so there were different things that I was able to learn as a mentee by just watching people work and trying not to take too much of their time. So I was always, if I was sitting and pair programming with someone, I was always watching them too and making sure that I wasn't, that if they were getting to a point where they were like, okay, I'm done pair programming, I would know to say, okay, I think this was really good. Thank you for your time. And I'm going to go back to my desk and use some of the things that I've learned.
That's that EQ that some developers don't have.
I think you can develop it though.
Yeah, no, but I think that's a fantastic point, is that obviously when you're making the ask, you don't think of what you can do as a mentee. And I mean, you've listed all the bullet points, I would say, of someone who wants to be mentored, of, you know, yeah, it's an important thing to say, because, and maybe this sounds a little cold, but I'm sleep deprived, so I'll say it. So some people say, oh, will you be my mentor, as if it's like an honor. And really it's just like a lot of unpaid free time. So it's important some reciprocity in the relationship. You know, if your colleagues, that's great. If it's a random person, you know, Carlton and myself are approached. I don't know. There needs to be some back and forth. Maybe we are learning about some project you're working on or some part of the community, but it's good to have in mind that it's not just a one-way street, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I try and help on like the forum, say, and a good question that invites a response, that they've done the work and so when you read it and then immediately you're like, oh yeah, there's the answer, or there's a point I'd make. Whereas the other question is like, just a dump, and it's like, oh, I can't, where do I even begin? I'd have to do hours of work to even start to answer that question.
It's like next level Google skills is knowing how to ask the right question, I think, right? How to frame it so it's concise, prove that you've done some work, but not have it just be, yeah, how do I build my app? Which I understand the impulse to ask such a question, but it's not answerable.
I mean, and you also, the other thing that really helps is that if you're working towards the same goal, so a lot of my mentor-mentee relationships at Cactus specifically, we would be on the same team together. So we were trying to get tickets done. And sometimes pair programming, you actually get things done more intelligently because you sort of step back and talk about the solution together. And then you are trying to reach the same goal. So pair programming can kind of, I don't know, it's a real positive, it's been a real positive experience for the most part for me.
I'm incredibly envious you've experienced it. I've never experienced it. I locked myself in a room for 2 years and sort of kind of learned Django and
I haven't done it in a long time, but I have done it in both experiences where I was working at Cactus and we would have pair programming time, usually because I would ask for it. Because other people are more reluctant maybe to ask for it. I'm not sure why, if they feel like they just would rather work on their own, or if they just feel like they don't want you to see the magic behind how they come up with solutions, which is a lot of Google for me.
Hang on, it's the exact lack of magic they don't want you to see, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
But I think that's another factor of figuring out when are you stuck enough to ask for help? And I suppose this goes in the bucket of experience along with Googling of, you know, like all, the three of us, we have a sense of like, I will spend a couple hours, maybe I'll sleep on something. But if at this point, if I'm truly stuck on something, I will, you know, kind of then raise my hand, but I don't immediately raise my hand. And I guess I'm just saying that there's a sense of when are you actually stuck versus when have you not done the work? And there's no need to spend a week on something at any level, but you should at least put the work in and prove that, you know, to Carlton's point about asking a forum question, if you say, here is this concise problem I have, here are the steps I have taken that didn't work, you can see where someone is on the journey versus when someone just is lazy, basically. And maybe they don't feel lazy, they're frustrated, but like you have to have like enough frustration to have tried.
I like the way the forums work too. I started typing a question into them recently before I had done a lot of research, and I liked I think it sort of popped up and said, are you ready to release this question? Are you ready to ask this question, or have you researched it more? And then I did a little more research on it and I didn't end up asking it, and I was glad I hadn't asked it. So I just liked that interface. I just wanted to give you that feedback.
Oh, on the official Django forum?
Yeah. I'm not sure who worked on the Django forums. Was it Carlton or?
No, it's a Rails app. No, it's Discourse, is it?
Yeah, it's Discourse. It's a textbook. I mean, it's a off the shelf white label thing. Andrew Godwin did a lot of the work to implement it. We, the Django Software Foundation, are now continuing to pay for that in going forward as part of the Django ops stuff, which I should call out, the head of Cactus Group, Tobias, is on the ops team and does quite a lot of unseen work to help the Django infrastructure.
That's awesome. Yeah, Tobias is great.
So, but I do want to get to, so eventually you left Cactus Group and you had this fantastic talk, which I wish I had seen. So I rolled my own job 4 years ago, and man, I would have saved me a lot of time if I'd seen your talk before that. So how did you get to learning? Because so many things I was like, yep, didn't think of that in advance, yep. So you left Cactus Group and then learned all these things about rolling your own job.
Yeah, so I never felt like I really left Cactus Group, although I did have like a goodbye lunch at the time. I ended up in 2017 moving to San Francisco for a year because my husband got a job offer out there. And so the decision up to me was, should I look for a job in San Francisco? There are all these, it's the land of tech opportunity, but with that comes whiteboard interviews. You mentioned whiteboard earlier, and I really was not interested in any more whiteboard interviews. I had been on a few and I didn't want to go that route. So I didn't really want to work for another tech company. I liked working at Cactus. So when we decided to move to San Francisco, which we only stayed there for a year, but when we decided to move out there, I asked Cactus if I could still work for them, but just based out of California. And they even had a client in Oakland at the time that I knew would benefit from me being out there. So I sort of brought that to them. And they were unable to deal with the taxes in California because California tax law is really complicated and different from North Carolina, where we're based. So they gave me the option. They sort of said, look, we can't work with California, unfortunately. We would love to keep you. Do you have any interest in contracting? And they have a number of contractors there. So I was familiar with contracting at Cactus. I was a full-time employee who was hired by Cactus, but I knew other contractors there and I knew what their life was like. And I thought, oh, this is an amazing opportunity. Like, I can take a step back from working full-time at an office where I'm required to put in my 40 hours of billable time every week. Hopefully it's billable. And I can set my hours and I can select my projects. This is what I knew from contractors. This is what I knew from how they were working. So I said, yeah, that sounds great. How do I do that? And they were really nice and said, well, you need to do that. You need to form your own business. And then we can hire you as a consultant. And you'll have to buy your own laptop. And that's what you'll have to do. So I ended up talking to every consultant I knew at the time, anybody who worked for themselves. I had like a 3-hour phone call with my friend Patrick, where he just runs his own business now, totally unrelated to what I do. But he gave me so much intel about, you know, whether or not I should form an LLC and how I should track my expenses. And it was amazing. So I have to give Patrick Esmond huge props for that. But also I talked to a number of other people. Victor, who I still work with now, he's on a client project with me and he runs his own small firm. He was also a huge help. I took him out to lunch and asked him. So I just had all these, you know, I had lunches and phone calls and emails where I just asked everybody I knew, because like I was talking with pair programming, that's my learning style. So I like to learn from people and experiences, and that's how I know I'm doing the right thing. And every single person I talked to told me to form an LLC. So that's, you know, that's one thing we can talk about today. You know, why form an LLC? So that's why I formed an LLC, because that was the feedback I was getting from everyone.
They told you.
Because Carlton, you've spent time as a consultant. Are there similar structures in Europe, or is it a totally different thing?
Yeah. So I had a limited company in the UK back in the early days, and I used to put all my work through that. And then when I came to Spain, I became self-employed. So, and now I'm self-employed. It's just, you know, it's Carlton Gibson. It's me. I haven't formed.
And then there's no legal entity on top.
No, there is. There is. You can form an SL, a Sociedad Limitada. You can form one of those. I've thought about it a couple of times, but because it's just me and, you know, I haven't got around to doing that at the moment. There's no, the autonomo status that you have as a self-employed person in Spain is got most of the benefits of that without, you know, the massive overheads. And bureaucracy in Spain is quite high. And as soon as you've got an SL, it's like every month more, you know, administrative costs. And for me, at the scale I run, it's just not worth it.
Well, I'm a sole proprietor still, which is, I guess, one of the three options, right? There's C-Corp, LLC, sole proprietor. I probably should be an LLC, but I haven't done that yet. But I loved how you covered this in your talk, because you really kind of laid out the landscape. But I agree. I think most people should be an LLC if you had to choose now.
In the UK, it was certainly like you get a limited company, the bureaucracy was very small and the benefits were very large. You know, I don't know what it's like in the States, but
it depends by state. I mean, because California, it's almost like $1,000 to have an LLC. And then there's, because actually the startup I worked at out there was an LLC. And, you know, but then some states it's a couple hundred dollars. And, but I think it's what, it's like $1,000 or something to set up, and then probably mid 500, something, depends on the state ongoing.
Yeah, I don't remember how much I pay per year. My accountant keeps track of that for me, but it's not very high in North Carolina. It was definitely higher in California. I think when I formed it, it was $800.
Yeah, 800 is the number I recall.
And then I got a refund of a partial refund because I moved in the middle of the year from them for that. Like, it was all very confusing, and but you know. Everything was legal as far as I was aware, because I went through LegalZoom to set up my LLC, which was another tip I got from a number of people who I talked to. They just said LegalZoom, it's just easy. You just fill out a wizard to form your LLC. And like Carlton was saying, this is really just particular to the US, but the nice thing about the LLC in the US is that it helps you separate yourself from your business, so that if the worst happens and you get sued, your business gets sued, your personal assets aren't liable, as long as you were doing a good job at keeping them separate.
Yeah, and that's what you need. And you need liability insurance, and you need an accountant, you mentioned, and you need to let the professionals do their job, because you don't know about accounting and tax rules and returns, and you know, and that just pay someone for that.
I pay my own taxes, Carlton. I probably
should. Oh, wow, you're right.
Well, part of me thinks, you know, I've got this fancy business degree, and but really, I should have one. I mean, I love how you have that really nice sheet, Aaron, that you linked to from your talk, the Google Doc, laying things out. Because I think that's great. In some ways, that's better than, like, I use TurboTax to pay my taxes in the U.S., and I use their QuickBooks Self-Employed, which is works great for me. So I have separate bank accounts set up for business and personal, which you have to, and I have a separate credit card. And so it all kind of flows through there, but it's...
Everybody I talk to seems to want to use accounting software. And I just really like having it all in a spreadsheet. I just find it so much, there's so much less overhead to just track your expenses in a single spreadsheet versus learning a UI for QuickBooks or whatever.
Well, it depends on how many expenses you have, I would say, because the nice thing is it just pulls in everything from your credit card. So if you have
that
whole
nice
number of automated expenses, that kind of helps. It'll estimate your taxes. But, well, and I think, and I like how you mentioned you found your person online, right? It wasn't a personal recommendation. And he's not in the same state either, which, because that's another concern, is that potentially state by state varies.
Yeah. So, one of the places I interviewed at a long time ago was Thumbtack. So I wouldn't have been aware of it if they hadn't contacted me to interview me. But that's how I found out about Thumbtack. And I really like their site. They've done a really, really nice job of basically replacing Angie's List.
Yeah.
In
Angie's
a free
List
way.
Is awful. I'll dump on them all over the place. They're terrible. They're like subpar Craigslist, but they prey on old people. They're no.
Oh no. Yeah, no, not a good site. But yeah, Thumbtack is really great. And so I went to Thumbtack, and I think they ask you what your project is. So I just said I was looking for a business accountant, and I went through the number of steps, and then a number of accountants sort of bid for the project. And the one I found was in Georgia. And this, at the time I was in California, he was in Georgia, and he said, yeah, I have a number of clients in California. That's fine. I'm very familiar with that tax law. And he had to learn the North Carolina law when I moved back to North Carolina, but that was fine. And he spent, I think, an hour with me on the phone, just talking me through things. And at the end of the phone call, I was like, yeah, absolutely, you're hired. This is great. So he's been my accountant since that time, since I hired him on Thumbtack. So I'm really, really happy with him. And he's become our personal accountant too. So he's great. And he does So I have to, in order to make 401k payments as an employer.
Yeah, let's talk about this.
We can talk about this a little bit, maybe, if you're ready. Yeah, so it's in order, so with 401k.
So do you have a solo 401? Do you have a solo 401k set up?
I have a solo 401k.
So do
I. So there's the employee contributions, which is the same for everybody. The max this year is what, 19,500, something like that.
Yes, for 2020.
In the year 2020. Yep. Yeah. So that is the max this year for everyone, employee contributions, no matter what. But there is this thing where if you're working for yourself, you can make an employer contribution. And if you do that, you need to calculate it based on your profits. And the way my accountant does that is by doing payroll. So he...
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about this. Yeah. So you have... because
I'm not an accountant, so I'll just tell you how he does it. I don't know
how
it works.
Okay, sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt. No. I get excited and I interrupt, but please speak. Yeah.
No, you're fine.
Carlton's laughing. He knows.
You're fine. I now pay him monthly to do my monthly payroll, and I pay myself my payroll by doing a direct deposit once a month on the same day every month. So it has to look like payroll. It has to be payroll. Like, you have to set the salary and pay that salary amount on the same day every month if that's what you're going to do, like the monthly salary, like you would if you were working for a monthly paid job somewhere else. And so he takes that monthly salary base level before the taxes come out, and I think it's up to 20% or 25. I forget the amount exactly.
Yeah, it's 25, and the combined amount is like 56 or something thousand. So if you make like 160, 170 net, then you can, the employee and the employer can, it's something like 56,000 total.
So I've never maxed it out. I don't make enough for that because I just don't make enough for that. But yeah, if you wanted
it's
to
a lot
max
more
it
than
out,
you can put aside at your normal 401k.
Exactly. It's a lot more pre-tax money that you can put aside. I mean, right now it's a pretty tumultuous time to put money into 401k. So we're all sort of questioning the reality of the stock market here in the US. But but that is true. Like, you can put more money in pre-tax, which means you're going to be taxed less, which is, you know, a good way to make more money.
Yeah, if you think you're going to make more now than in the future, it's a good move. And the employee side, you have the option of doing Roth if you want, so you can make Roth 401k contributions, which are post-tax, but then when you take the money out, you don't get taxed on it. So anyway, sorry, this is, I overspend time on this stuff.
I have to say, my brother-in-law is a financial planner and a tax accountant and a business tax accountant. He's really, really smart. He's the FI tax guy. But I just spoke to him last weekend, and he is a big proponent of employee contributions before employer contributions. So really maxing out the employee contributions because of the way that the employer contributions get taxed on the way out.
Well, yeah, because when you run your own business, I mean, you get nailed with self-employment taxes, and there's all the, well, you don't get nailed, but that's the biggest expense. Because as a regular employer, it's like 15.3% total, which is Medicaid, and then like the 7.5% that the employer and employee pays. So if you've never worked for yourself or run a business, you just see the 7% taken out, but the employee is already paying a whole bunch of stuff on top of that, including for health insurance. But traditionally, pre the Trump tax thing, where they have this thing called QBI, which is qualified basic income, which is 20% off for certain types of LLCs, which software consultancies fall into, you would set up a LLC as an S corp, so you could be taxed as a corporation, but in fact be an LLC, and then you could, in theory, like if you made $10 million, you could say, well, the average for a software developer is $150,000. And so I will get paid the full, you know, the full tax on the $150,000. But then beyond that, I don't have to pay the extra self-employment taxes. And that was why you would set up payroll historically. Though I'm a little bit interested in why you set up payroll when you don't do that. But I believe you're financial experts, but We're getting too inside baseball on this. Yeah. There's a lot to think. There's a lot to think about, especially the first year. It's so much non-programming, non-work time to configure all
right,
this.
But that's the point, right? Is like this is a talk about being a freelance software developer. Like this is what we're here to chat about, and it's business. Like you think, oh, I'm just going to be a freelancer. I'm going to do coding. No, you're going to do business. Like all the week is business, and then you get 10 minutes to do some actual client work.
I found the first year I really took a hit, and I was really quite frustrated by it. But this last year it was more pro forma, and I was grateful to have some flexibility around retirement stuff. But I think to Carlton's point, you don't think about all these things until you do it, and it is a serious cost. And probably it's great that you found an accountant you can trust. I've heard quite a few horror stories, unfortunately.
Oh boy, yeah, that's scary. Yeah, I have an accountant I can trust, and then I have my backup of my brother-in-law who I talk to on the phone and make sure that I'm also, that it sounds like everything I'm doing is right. And like I said, I did a ton of research for the talk, and whether that research was talking to my accountant or watching YouTube videos on forming a business, I found there's this channel called All Up in Ya Business. And she's a lawyer. I forget where she's based out of. I think she's Southern, and she's amazing.
She has a podcast too, right? Because I think you recommended it in the talk, and I checked it out.
She has a YouTube channel. I don't know if she has a podcast. That's I hope so. I did recommend a bunch of podcasts. So I'm like a podcast addict for sure. But she has a YouTube channel. That's where I learned a lot of things. I recommended Choose FI has a really good podcast on the financial independence movement. And so there was an episode with Alan Donegan where he talks about running your own small business. He started the pop-up business school. And when we're ready to talk about clients, like there's a lot of stuff that I learned from that podcast about that.
Well, that seems like a seamless segue.
So yeah, shall we talk about maybe finding clients?
Yeah, because there's two things. One is finding clients, and then the other thing that comes into that is then when you've got clients, still keep finding clients. So we should talk about both those things.
And they both give me stomach aches if I think about it too much. If I think about, you know, my contract, because I work on a contract basis, and yeah. I'm not sure if you both similarly work on what sort of working basis are you all on? Like I'm on a 6-month contract right now.
Well, I've been freelance for ever and ever and ever. Currently, I do the Django Fellow work, which is part-time. They do that on a yearly basis, and then I have other clients around the side. But I've lived on this, you know, this contracting basis, and the sort of the nervousness of it is the lack of security. It's not like you haven't got a job. And so you need to be conscious of, well, this contract will end, and then what?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so you have multiple contracts. Are those contracts like a certain number of hours per week? So I'm on a current contract of six months. They had just extended me for 6 more months. So it just began in April. And I've agreed to do 30 hours of coding a week for them. And that includes meetings and things.
Yep.
And that's sort of my happy medium there is coding for 30 hours a week. Because any more than that, and I start to get really drained. So that's me personally.
Hard. Over in the years, I've done things where I consider that to be a full-time gig, right?
Because right.
By the time you've done 30 hours of actual work and then a few admin stuff, that's your working week. And I've done, over the years, I've had clients where I've been working for that one company for a while. And that's great because you get loads of money come in. It's nice. But then when the contract runs, it's like, well, actually, now I'm essentially unemployed and I've got to find some more. And so as I got older, what I favored was, you know, half a day for you, you know, a client where I might come and do, you know, a few days every few months, you know, that kind of, and have a bunch of those because I find that on average, that's more secure. That's more sustainable for me. I don't know.
When times are great, they're great, but then they can get bad all of a sudden. And I mean, for me, I've done project based primarily, but honestly, in the last year, I've just been able to focus on my books and stuff, which is nice. But I do think about when I think about doing it, honestly, I think I would maybe go through an agency just so I don't have to deal with all the client management stuff.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of burden. And so, you know, for me, I'll probably go back to some consulting later this year, but probably within the context of having someone else manage that. And I focus on code as much as I can and not deal with that business side of things.
I think it's really hard to find a client who, and maybe you all haven't had the same experience, who will agree to 20 hours a week. Or,
well, they always want you full time, right? They're always like, start as a consultant, and then they kind of want to backdoor you into being full time. And it's like, well, if I wanted to work full time, I would, but.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, no, I think when it with experience as well, like, you know, when what I aim for now, I wouldn't have been able to get 5-10 years ago. I just didn't have the authority to say, no, I could do half a day. But, you know, who wants half a day? Well, you know.
There's a maturity of client, too, to recognize they can get value out of that, too, I would say. Right? I mean, that's part of some clients, you know, just like they ask for whiteboard interviews and stuff, and then some have completely unrealistic expectations. And I'm sure, you know, you can see this, Aaron, right? You can sort of sniff when a client is going to be awful to work for because they don't really understand reality with project estimates.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I can sniff that. I mean, I hope so.
You're aware that it's you know,
I'm
in the
aware
back of your
that,
mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to work for more technical clients for sure, because they understand the reality of the difficulty and the complexity. But yeah, I don't know. I just find it difficult to find clients who are willing to do, even when you're going through an agency, who are willing to say, okay, 20 hours a week, that's fine. 10 hours a week, that's okay. But yeah, when I started consulting, I was working in California for this Oakland client for Cactus, and I think I was doing 25 hours for them and then 15 for Wharton, who were my former employers who found out that I was consulting through a social media post that I posted. Actually, two ways. So there were two ways that I connected with Wharton. One way was I posted to Facebook that I was going to start working for myself. And that post got a lot of likes from a lot of friends who either, you know, were connected to me from my Wharton job or, you know, elsewhere. And I guess word got around to a person who I knew who was working at my former department at Wharton. And she was excited to hear that I had sort of become a consultant and wanted to work with me. So she reached out to me from that social media post, and I still work with her department part-time. And so that was really cool that was this sort of like organic way that I found a client. And then the other way I reconnected with Wharton was I was at a PyCon a couple years back, and I ran into a former coworker, and we got to talking about his current boss and my old boss at Wharton and what a great boss he is. And I said, you know, I keep meaning to send Jason an email. Jason is such a good boss. He was so technical at that time in my career where I needed someone to be technical and help guide me more towards framework programming. And, you know, and this friend of mine was like, yeah, absolutely, Jason's the best. And I said, I keep meaning to send him an email. And he was like, just do it. Just send him an email. Just send him a thank you email. So I got back from PyCon and I sent Jason an email, and it was not like the intention was not to get work from my old boss. It was just my intention was pure. It was just, I want to let you know that you were a good boss. Thank you. Just a gratitude email. And
but you did mention that you're available in the same email.
No, he found out. I was available because he just knew I was available because of this other friend. So
no, but that's
I ran into. So
you're keeping up the contacts, like keeping up with it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so he I didn't mention in the email that I was available. He responded, "Thank you for this email. I'm having a really rough day. So this just came at like a really good time for me. Also this other person just mentioned that you're working for yourself now. Is that true? Because we are finally moving that project you worked on to Django and we could use your help. So I had worked on this like massive Cold Fusion website right before I left. And so I had the background knowledge and I had the, you know, I had, then I had the, like all of the couple of years of experience of working at Cactus full-time at Django. So I was kind of the perfect developer for that project. And that worked out. So I worked on that for a little while. So I was, when I was in California starting out consulting, I was working on that part-time and working on this Oakland client part-time.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was working out. And then I sort of, and then it was nice when the Oakland contract ended, I could switch to full-time hours with Wharton for a while and sort of like backfill and get that project sort of more quickly done towards their deadline, which was nice.
Yeah. And then do you find most of your clients come through that kind of organic or, contact network way?
So far, yes. I mean, I've been doing this for probably fewer years than both of you now, because I started in 2017.
Okay.
So far it's been that way. And then also by my work with Cactus. So they know me and they like to connect me with work when they have it as a consultant. I've also worked with another consulting agency. So I've worked with two different consulting agencies since going full time. I prefer between the two of them. Cactus worked out a little better just for the time zones because we're in the same time zone and I'm local to them now. So that's been really nice.
Yeah.
So you left California though. That's what we're getting at, right? So
yeah. Yeah. We knew 1 month in that we did not want to stay there.
Oh, really? I lived out there for a while.
Yeah.
What was it for you? Because I would say it's a really fun, but it's interesting within 1 month because I love being there and I moved back for family reasons, but it's an incredibly transient place. So there's this initial rush of like, oh, you're not from here? I'm not from here. Let's hang out. As well as like, you work in tech? No way. And then you find out that no one's from there. Everyone works in tech. And, you know, some of the negative aspects creep in, but I guess you figured that out faster than I did.
What part were you in? Were you in San Francisco?
So 2010 to 2013, I was in Cal Hollow. I worked in on Second Street, which is quite. Do you know Cal Hollow?
No, I don't.
What part of the city were you in?
Inner Sunset.
Yeah. Well, no. So Cal Hollow is in between Pack Heights and Marina.
I know Pack Heights. Yeah.
And the Marina. So I was right
Cal
next to the Presidio.
Hollow. Cal Hollow. No, I remember. Yeah, Cal Hollow. Yeah. I thought you were saying Cal Hollow, but no, it's fine.
There's a lot to like about the West Coast when you come from the Northeast, as I do.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly miss the produce a lot.
Oh, my God. Year-round farmers markets you just walk to and
avocados
never had such...
at the farmers market were like,
cheap.
What?
Yeah, it's like, oh, my God. Yeah, and it's sunny. And I mean, I keep having kids in different states. I have an infant now and I'm walking outside and it's dark at 10 a.m. and it was raining. And, you know, in California, my oldest one, I would just walk her every day in the sun and, you know, but it's not everything.
Yeah. There were a multitude of reasons we didn't stay. I guess it was very, very expensive and it felt like it to me to be around a place where people can't, this is going to get rather philosophical, but where people can't work at a grocery store and live at the same place where they work at a grocery store feels unfair to me.
Or be a teacher.
Yeah, exactly. My husband works in the education system, but he had a pretty good salary that brought him out there in the education system. It felt like end stage capitalism. It felt really not great. We were both doing okay, and we were able to afford this adorable one-bedroom apartment in Inner Sunset that was just gorgeous. It was great. I went for a walk in Golden Gate every day. It was a beautiful place to live. But yeah, being that far away from family, and then just how difficult it is for regular non-programmers to live there.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to ask you as well is, this may seem like a segue, but in the context of consulting in workplaces, diverse workplaces? Because I feel like you've had a good experience with that, and I know you have some thoughts on the benefits and how to cultivate that, since we aren't in a particularly diverse industry.
Yeah. So I would say that if I get to know a new place that I could work, and I look around and it looks like everybody looks the same age and came from the same background, that's a bad sign to me. Even if I fit into that, you know, even if I'm like, oh yeah, I'm the same way. We're all around the same age. I think it's really important to have a diverse ecosystem at your workplace, whether that's a client or you know, if you're full-time. And the place I'm working, the client I'm working with right now is a client based out of Oakland, and their development team is all over the map as far as ages, and it's coming from really different backgrounds. So it's really nice. And I've worked on teams where everyone is kind of in their 20s and excited to work and you know, isn't really familiar with burnout and isn't really worried about it too much.
They will be.
They want you to hang out and play StarCraft after work.
Yeah. So well, I mean, maybe or yeah, hang out.
I mean, I was the old guy 10 years ago at a startup, so, you know.
Yeah.
But like this startup thing and the late stage capitalism and all of that, is and the whiteboard interviews, isn't it like that they go for that particular young, that don't really know, they might, you know, perfectly talented and whatnot, but have no life experience kind of worker, so that they can put them in to the sweatshop environment and really get their money's worth, right? Isn't that why they hire them and why they have that hiring process? And
I don't think it's that insidious, Carlton. I mean, I think that's, well, I think that is some of it. I think that it's, you have a lot of, and here I'm going to burn a bunch of bridges, but you have a lot of founders who are in their early 20s, they just want to hire their friends. You have the adults in the room who are in their 30s or 40s who are all male Peter Pans. And I don't think it's, they're sitting around, you know, smoking a pipe thinking we want to be evil. They're just thinking when it gets to the culture fit part of who do we want to hang out with, they want to hang out with people like themselves who are all about work and fit those profiles. I don't think it's quite as, I mean, certainly the startup I worked at, we weren't thinking I want to exploit these young MIT Stanford grads, though that's basically the only people we hired because of a combination of they fit into the culture, they pass the test. Our other employees, you know, were kind of like that. So I'm not saying it's not there, but I think it's more, I don't know, evil's more benign, or it just sort of creeps up on you. It's just you want to hire your friends.
It could be that it's more systemic than... It's not that the individual in the position is sitting there thinking, ha ha, I must exploit them. But it's like the whole way that it's structured just ends up with
those. You just grow, you know, if you're a male, you hit your 30s, you grow a neck beard and you move down the peninsula and work at Oracle or something. I remember being there being like, where's a 30-something male programmer? You know, and they exist in many places, but it is that combination. I think also it self-selects. I mean, Carlton, you and I wouldn't want to work in that environment now. And they probably wouldn't want us either. So it's also fresh off the boat of the airplane from wherever. And but it is kind of intoxicating and quite fun for a while, I would say, to go from not being surrounded by a tech community to being around it all the time.
I've recommended your episode on aging gracefully as a programmer to so many people, because I think it wasn't even a very long podcast episode. I think it was like half an hour long, and it was perfect. Start to finish. So thank you for that.
Well, that's talking about
burnout, all that stuff.
Carlton's talk. That's how we met. I was one of the like 200 people who's seen it on YouTube, and I sent him a note.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, when I was a youngster, I did London startup scene a bit, and you know, you're right, it was fun, but it's not how you're gonna fill up your 401k. Okay.
But getting back to clients, there were a couple other things I kind of wanted to mention on clients too. And this podcast episode has been a little organic itself.
It's chat, it's Django chat.
Django chat, yeah.
Good. Yeah. So one thing is, there's a podcast episode of Choose FI where they interview this guy named Alan Donegan, and he started the startup or the pop-up business school in London. And he's a really interesting guy. And his mantra is always be caring. So it's the ABC sort of, you know, when you think of ABC, you might be thinking of that line, always be closing in terms of, you know, sales and finding clients and all those things. But he sums it up a different way. He says, always be caring. And so I really like that mantra. And that's definitely carried me through my whole career before I was a consultant. I really cared about the projects I was working on. I really cared to make sure that, you know, the technology was right. Sure, like that's really important, but make sure that it's accomplishing what the client, whether that's an internal client that you're working for as a full-time employee or, you know, whatever that client is, that stakeholder, make sure that it's what they want. It's going to be best suited to their needs and you're listening to them. And so I really want to stress that. That's really helped me connect with clients because my old bosses want to work with me again because I made our stakeholders happy. That's really important. So
yeah,
that's one really big thing I kind of wanted to drive home. I don't know if you wanted to talk, had any thoughts on that.
No, other than to agree in absolutely 100%. Like, finding clients is difficult, right? One way of getting a sustainable freelance business or solo business is to have clients come back to you. And they may come back, you know, 8 years later, and they might be like, you know, I need you again. And it's like, they ain't going to do that unless you do a good job. And it's a good job by their eyes, not your eyes. Oh, I used, you know, the latest tech framework and, you know, look how it was containerized and I deployed it with, you know, these special... None of that matters a shred. What matters is their goals, their outcomes and, you know, yeah. So, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, reputation matters. Everything is a really small world when you get down to it, right? Which is kind of nice and sort of too bad when some people don't realize that, but... The reality is there's, you know, there's an endless supply of work that needs good people to do it. And people who do good work know people who do good work. And that's what you look for, right? Yeah. Whatever side you're on, if you want a colleague or you want to hire someone, it's a reputation.
Yeah. And I think there is an endless supply of work out there. I mean, not right now, there's not because of the whole coronavirus, but the economy will come back. And beyond the tech bubble, beyond San Francisco, there's a whole world that you can get working.
And the problem is a lack of talented people who can communicate rather than work. May not feel that way, but that's the case.
And speaking of communicating and building a reputation, the other thing that goes along with that, the other piece that I want to talk about with finding clients is having becoming somewhat known, whether it's through giving talks or writing blog posts, but putting yourself out there a little bit. Like whatever your comfort level is. So I felt comfortable to give that Django talk last year, but I wouldn't have been comfortable giving a talk at DjangoCon maybe 2 years prior to that. That was the talk that I was ready to give at that time. So, and that led to this podcast, which was really cool. I also have been writing technical blogs for Cactus. So it's a nice... that's a nice feature of when I was working full-time at Cactus, they encouraged us to write blogs. And then when I went off and became a consultant, I said, you know, I've written some blogs for you. I still am interested. I still like come up with ideas that I want to write and they still pay me to write blogs. I just have to go through a different process with them and sort of get, you know, give them a, you know, here's how many hours I think I'm going to spend writing this blog and would you, you know, pay me for that many of hours? Would you be interested in publishing this topic that I want to talk about? And so that's another way to sort of get your reputation built up online.
Yeah. It's one thing I would recommend people to get involved in an open source project as one possible avenue. And it can be Django itself or it can be one of those ecosystem projects. And if you become you know, helpful there, and you just do a little bit. It doesn't have to be a lot. It can be an hour a week. It can be, you know, a couple of times a month, a couple of hours, you know, not a lot, but that adds up over time. And all of a sudden it's, oh yeah, that person, they maintain, you know, this so-and-so plugin.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I mean, people who listen to this podcast know that that's always the advice I give, is have some open source code or contributions and have a post or a talk to get your name out there. I think it's hard for a lot of developers who may be a little more introverted by nature to do, but it is, you know, someone's going to Google you, and what are they going to find, right? Like, if they find existing work, then the interview and stuff can be about that. Otherwise, it's, you're going to go through the whiteboard treadmill. But I think that's the hard thing in a way, is that, like, we think, you know, I should be doing, you know, I should spend those hours a week coding or doing like super advanced Python or Kubernetes or whatever. But the reality is you should be spending it on your network, on communicating. And it, you know, I always take attitude over aptitude. And part of attitude is communication. So once you hit a baseline, it's all about your attitude and your communication skills, because you can kind of figure anything out versus the loner who maybe isn't an expert in some area, but no one wants to work with. That's not who gets hired.
Right. Yeah.
So we're coming up on time. We have links to, oh, I wanted to ask. So what's the story? So you're, Aaron Rachel is the name of your consulting thing? Because when you set up an LLC, you can't put a trademark in there, right? So like, I can't call mine Learn Django LLC, for example.
Oh, right. Yeah, you cannot call it that. Yeah, maybe you could misspell it or something. I don't know, but that would be pretty weird. You can't put a trademarked name into it. It should be easy to be, you should be able to spell it easily. So that's, you know, kind of an important thing when you're coming up with your LLC name. I forget what else was on that slide, but yeah, you can go back to my talk and see. And then when you actually submit it to your state, if you're in the United States and you're forming an LLC, if it's already been taken, then it's going to get returned to you and you're going to have to come up with a different name. So you should be able to go to your state's SOS.gov website, your state's Secretary of State website, and look up the names and make sure that it isn't currently taken. But yeah, you can't have the word Python in the name of your business, or probably the name Django. I assume that's trademarked. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Part of what the Django Software Foundation does is we enforce the Django trademark. So
you know,
I should know. And naming is, it's almost like startup names. It's one of those things where it doesn't matter at all, and yet you spend an inordinate amount of time on it. At least that's my kind of philosophical take on it, after spending an inordinate amount of time on startup names. And, you know, I mean, what do I have? As a sole proprietor, I have a DBA, so doing business as account. So that's how so that's what I use for my checking account. So it's like still me, but it's labeled as something else. And that's how my mail. And sometimes I'm like, oh, do I like the name that I have? Like, mine's still River Press, but like, no one cares.
Yeah. It might be important to have a separate business checking account if you don't have one already.
Oh yeah, you should have that. But I'm saying the name for your LLC or your,
oh, right,
your DBA, like, to your point, it should be easily spelled. It should be, but it's not. That's not what's going to make or break your business.
I don't think so. No.
No.
Yeah. I don't think so. Cactus has like a misspelling of the word cactus. When you think about it, C-A-K-T-U-S, and it hasn't seemed to hurt them. So I don't
Carlton,
know.
You have Nominal?
Yeah, Nominal, which was an error. Like, so I finished a philosophy degree of 2 or 3, and thought, I'll start a company, I need a name, I'll call it Numenal, why not, reminiscent of Kant and all of these things I love so much. No one can spell Numenal, no one can even say it. So like, for years it was like, how do you spell that? I was like, I'm not changing it, I can't be bothered, like, just, I'm keeping it, like, oh well. That was,
yes.
So I did learn that the hard way. Don't have a name that people can't, they read, they go, how, what,
no one said, oh, Kant. Maybe
go for like a short name, like Aaron Rachel Consulting was my website, so it was aaronrachelconsulting.com, which feels really long. And finally recently I got the URL aaronrachel.dev, And so I was like, oh, that's so much easier to tell people to go to now. So that makes me really happy.
Thank you so much for coming on. I think your resources are fantastic. Again, I love that you have those deep links to the Google Docs and the spreadsheets. That's the kind of stuff that, because you have a bunch of things you link to from the talk. It's not just the accounting. I think there's five or six. To me, that's sort of like sanding inside like a bureau or something. That's like Steve Jobs' analogy, or like the back of like a cupboard. Like, people don't really see that, but someone who takes a peek is like, oh, this person cares about what they're doing. They're doing a really good job. Like, I love that you did that in your talk, because you could have easily saved those hours. But I looked at those sheets, and I hope others do as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks. I've actually updated the sheets. Maybe I should update my shared sheet too, to make it a little bit easier. But yeah. Yeah, I think that layout was nice and easy to follow. So thank you. I'm glad you appreciated it.
Anything else, Carlton?
No. Just thank you for coming on. It was a great chat. I love that we spent a good half of it talking about accounting, because that's freelancing.
Thanks for having me. And can I say thank you for having such diverse guests on your podcast? There are so many coding podcasts out there that don't do that.
Coding podcasts don't have the Django community, you see.
Yeah, so it's the community. It's the community. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Thank you. We do put some thought into it. And it does. We're trying to reflect the Django community. So
excellent.
All right. We're @Django on Twitter. We have links to Aaron's website, and we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Join us next time. Bye-bye.